Hi, my name is Adriana Matos Nieves. I'm 25 years old. I'm here with my thesis advisor, Vidu Garg. And today is July 29th, 2019, and we're in Columbus, Ohio.
Hi, my name is Vidu Garg. I'm 49 years old, and today is Monday, July 29th, 2019. And we are here in Columbus, Ohio, and I'm here with Adriana Matos Nieves, who's one of my PhD students in my research laboratory. And we're here.
All right. So I feel like the reason that I asked you to do this was after Weinstein, that we were talking about the genesis of all cardiovascular scientists, like who trained who. And I know our story, it's you trained me and Deepak trained you. But I don't know like what your training looked like in Deepak's lab. And the stories that you have from that lab and the lessons learned. So that was the main reason that I wanted to invite you here today. So I guess we can start by you just telling me your like background story, like growing up in what place and academic background, stuff like that.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to start from the beginning. And so I was actually born in India, New Delhi, India. And then my father was doing his PhD in electrical engineering. And so he actually left soon after I was born. And when I was 6 months of age, I actually went and lived with my grandparents, my mom's parents. And my grandfather was in the Indian Foreign Service. So I went to Denmark and lived with him and my grandmother and my aunts for about 3 years before joining my parents and my sister in Virginia, Virginia Tech, where my dad was doing his PhD. And so then we kind of moved around a little bit. So I lived there, lived in Portland, Oregon, actually lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But I kind of always say that I grew up in Pittsburgh because that's where I essentially went from fifth grade onward into high school and where I graduated high school. And so from there, went to a kind of combined undergraduate and medical school program at Penn State University and then Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia. And during that time, I became interested in pediatric cardiology. And actually, my parents moved out to Portland, Oregon again. And I did a research fellowship supported by the American Heart Association where I worked with a pediatric heart surgeon. And so that was kind of my interest initially. And then ended up going into pediatrics and did it here in Columbus, Ohio at Nationwide Children's, and then moved to Dallas and where I did my pediatric cardiology fellowship training in at UT Southwestern, and then ended up in the lab and ended up in Deepak Srivastava's lab, stayed a few years there, and then moved here to Columbus, Ohio about 10 years ago. So
all over the place. So I guess from that, I'm just interested, since your dad did a PhD, were you trying to deviate from that kind of lifestyle and do an MD instead?
So I'm from India. My parents are from India. And so essentially, if you're Indian, your parents moved here, you were given two options if what you can do as a career. You can either go into medicine or you can go into engineering.
Yeah.
And so as growing up, those were my two options. And I chose medicine, and that's why I kind of went into this combined program even out of high school. I would say, though, as I went through the process, I mean, there was times where I considered other careers and stuff, but and then it wasn't really till doing some of these other things that kind of drove me into, cardiology and medicine and such.
Okay. Let me see what else. You said something else that I wanted to. So let's just do another question. So you said you just like cardiology. Was that just like, oh, I took this one anatomy course and that was it?
No, it was actually, so when I worked with this pediatric heart surgeon, so I think that got me a little bit more interested in, and obviously what I was doing there was essentially collecting data from medical charts, looking at a surgical procedure and looking how these patients did. So that experience, and then during that time, I also got to shadow him, and so I got to watch heart surgeries, actually, I spent 2 summers with them, and I went back the second summer. I actually got to go in the operating room and do stuff, and I got to go on rounds with them on the weekends and see the patients. So that whole exposure kind of got me really interested in it. I think ultimately, as I started learning about the heart in classes and stuff, it was just more the physiology and just the logical nature of kind of how the heart works. And when you start combining it with pediatric cardiology, where you have some of these different lesions, it's just kind of like a puzzle in terms of kind of figuring out like what to do. And so it's kind of a, I don't know, it was just fun figuring out like why and what you should do and how you should take care of these patients. And I think that was the biggest thing that drew me to wanting to study the heart and specifically pediatric cardiology.
Cool. So when you're in Deepak's lab, is that like a thing medical students have to do as a fellowship in a lab?
So when you're doing your clinical training, so when you do your regular pediatric training, you don't need to do that. But once you do your fellowship, there is allotted research time.
Okay.
And so I had about a year and a half. But even before I went to his lab, I had already kind of thought about doing research as a career. So I knew I wanted to do pediatric cardiology, finishing up my pediatric training. But then I was kind of looking at the different things that you can do within pediatric cardiology, because I didn't want to go into private practice. I wanted to stay in the academic kind of setting. And I had the options of like, oh, you can be an interventional cardiologist and do procedures in the cath lab or study arrhythmias, abnormal heart rhythms, or you could be a heart failure, heart transplant doctor. And I was kind of found myself kind of more interested in trying to understand why. And I think that's just my personality in terms of, you know, even in high school, I was, you know, the nerdy kid who did all the science fairs and stuff. I like science. I like asking questions and trying to understand why. And so before I even interviewed, I said, you know, I'm considering a more of a science or, you know, career. And so I had the opportunity when I was there, and this is pure luck. You know, I moved there to do my fellowship in 1997, and Deepak moved there in 1996. So he didn't really exist even when I was interviewing. I think he was in the process of moving, and I did a phone interview with him. So it was just kind of luck that I fell into that area and into that lab. And when you're there, I had about a year and a half, and that's when I kind of went into his lab to do research.
Okay. So we now know that Deepak's lab is really big. So why don't you just tell us what it was like back in 1997 in Deepak's lab?
In 1997, it was a very small lab. So he had been trained by Eric Olson, and so Eric Olson had also moved from MD Anderson in 1995, 1996. And so at that point, when I started, they hadn't even fully separated. So the lab meeting was one lab meeting, and so the trainees and Deepak's lab would present at a larger lab meeting with a lot of the trainees in Eric's lab. So that was a little bit different. And the lab was essentially, there was a couple of postdocs. One was Hiro Yamagishi, who's from pediatric cardiologist from Japan. There was a lab manager. I'm trying to think, and there may be one other pediatric critical care doc, Aruna, who was also there in the lab. And so it was, you know, a handful of people who had kind of migrated toward Deepak and you know, were doing research. There's also a graduate student, his first graduate student, Aparna, who was also there in the lab. So it was small, and it was a relatively close-knit group, but we're also next to this giant operation, which was Dr. Olson's laboratory.
Cool. So I guess I just want to know, since you run the lab, our lab, so well, and I can say that because you can't give me a raise. like, did you bring with you stuff that Deepak taught you about running a lab or, like, treating your employees? Or was that something that was just innate to you to do so within the GARG lab?
Yeah. I think it's something that I learned. I learned it at UT Southwestern. So you have to remember, so I went through medical training. I'd never been through a graduate school program. Even the research experiences that I had here in Columbus before I went there, it was a physician-run lab, and there was basically technicians, and there wasn't really students. And so when I moved there and went into the lab for the first time, it was my first exposure. And that exposure was not just to Deepak's lab, but also to Eric Olson's lab. And I would say that they both, to some extent, run their labs somewhat similarly in that manner, in terms of it's a it's a family, and so everybody kind of knows each other, and it's more of a, I don't want to say that it's community, family, and I think it's funny in that way. So there's all the good things about being a family, and there's all the bad things about being a family that are all within that lab. And so in terms of that sense, in terms of, you know, closeness and bonding and stuff, I think I learned that from Eric's and Deepak's laboratory. I think some of the things that in terms of, you know, really thinking about high, you know, focusing on, you know, the level of science that you want to do and the rigor of science, I think it also came from both of those laboratories and the trainees that were in those labs and kind of how they thought, and just that environment that really kind of shaped how I wanted to run my lab. And even the questions that we ask in our lab, I think it's all been influenced by those experiences that I had when I was in the lab.
Okay. So your biggest takeaway from Deepak's lab, are you going to say it was your nature paper?
Well, I can say there was some, it clearly influenced and helped me in my career, yeah. You know, is those papers. But, you know, I think there's a variety of things. I think one of the things is, how do you run a lab? Mm-hmm. You know, I think in terms of the responsibilities that you give your trainees and, you know, a level of trust, but also that level of support. So I think there's a balance in terms of, you want to support them, but you also want them to learn to be independent and think on their own. And I think that's just kind of the experiences that I saw there were essentially the individuals that I kind of looked up to and were, you know, I thought great students or postdoctoral trainees were the ones who really took that level of independence and took it to the next level. They actually added to the lab and pushed the field. And so it may be, you know, Eric Olson's lab or Deepak Srivastava's lab, but really it's those trainees that kind of brought in new things and pushed it and pushed the field forward with that level of support and having the resources to do that. So,
right.
But, you know, I think your question was kind of, what was the greatest thing from the lab? I think is learning. It was really, it was that that exposure and learning how to run a lab. And and I think that is what I gained the most. Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly, yes, getting some of those papers out and, you know, making those discoveries were great. But then knowing what to do from the next steps, that's what I learned in the lab, right? That's not enough. It's not enough to say, okay, I found a gene that causes this congenital heart disease. The question is, how? How does it cause the disease? Can you do something to treat the disease? And really going full circle. And it's not just stopping there.
Okay. Let me see. What else? So being scientists, our work life is very different from other people. So what lessons has your work life taught you that you think that I should know?
That you should know?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that's a difficult question.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, in the end, especially like the path that like I've chosen where, you know, I'm still a physician, also trying to run a lab. I think it's trying to find balance in terms of doing all of that. And it's tricky, to say the least, in terms of where do you go and where do you put your time. I think the only thing I would say to you is, when I look at my life in terms of trying to balance, you know, practicing medicine, doing research, and having a family and kids and being a father and a husband, is priorities. And you just have to figure out what's important in terms of what can you do, or what can someone else do for you,
right.
And what are the things that you have to do, that it's not replaceable, and sort that out. And I think that's the advice I would give you, no matter what you do. It doesn't matter what you do in your whole life, is you just have to figure out there's certain things where it's a chore. And if it's a chore and you have other things that you can do that are more important to you, then you know, see if you can get some other way for those to get done. Sometimes that requires financial means.
Yeah.
So I'll push that, put that out there. But if you can, that's, you know, it's an easy way to start prioritizing in terms of different things. I went to a fellow, I was one of the speakers in a course for cardiology fellows, and at one of these national meetings, it was a little seminar series, and one of the other persons was a very senior investigator, a female cardiologist, and one of the young cardiology fellows asked her, she goes, how did you do this? Like, how do you find that much time? And she was essentially like, I pay people to do stuff that
I don't want to do.
That there's things that anyone can do, mm-hmm. you know, but no one can be a parent at your kid's, you know, sporting event. That has to be you. You can't replace that with someone else. And so if you think about all the things that need to get done, they're not going to be done as well as you would do them. But there are certain things that other people can do, and there are certain things that can't. Mm-hmm. And I would even say that even if you're in my role as a PhD advisor, there are certain things that you can get from anyone, you know, but there are certain things that you need from your advisor.
Right.
And so you just have to kind of think about all the different things on that list mm-hmm. of things that need to get done and say, okay, what can someone else do? Where can you can get help? And where is it like this can only be you? And those are things that you need to do and you need to do well.
Right. So. I've been thinking about that a lot lately, about prioritizing mm-hmm. Now that I'm thinking about graduation. And then I have my RITA commitments, so my community outreach commitments, which I love, mm-hmm. But they take up so much time. So it becomes this balance of what matters right now, which mm-hmm. is my PhD thesis, and I care about the project versus these things that I want in the future. So, yeah.
But I think when you're thinking about those things is where can you get help? Where can you, you know, function in a more supervisory role? But again, a lot of that takes a lot. Like, where do you find this person?
Mm-hmm.
And then even if you find that person, they may not do it the exact way that you do it, which you may not like that much. But you have to be willing to say, okay, from a bigger picture, is what they're doing wrong? Probably not. Mm-hmm. It's just different.
Yes.
And then you just have to accept that and say, okay, that's not the way I would do it, but they're still accomplishing a goal.
Right.
And then it gives you more time. And I think that's one of the things that it's hard to start saying, okay, it's kind of reducing some of your responsibilities because you're only one person and there's only mm-hmm. 24 hours in a day.
Right.
And so in terms of finding that time. But there's sacrifices. In the end, there's sacrifices for me from so many people involved in the different things that I end up doing, because there's no way that I can do all of this without mm-hmm. people. And I think the other thing is knowing what you can do and what you can't do. And so I think I've heard somebody say, you know, you have to know what you know and you have to know what you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is basically saying, like, ask for help.
Right.
Right. If you don't know how to do something, no one's going to say that you can't learn how to do it. But it's going to take a lot of time.
Right.
And so reaching out and using the resources that you have, and then also being also willing to help other people, right? That's so essentially how it works. It's like, well, someone else needs help, so you help them. But then when you need help, you get help. And,
right.
And that's essentially creating that community to allow that to occur.
Yeah. So. When I was training our summer students, Elliot and Emily, mm-hmm. They would never want to ask for help. And I'm mm-hmm. like, why are you wasting so much time trying to reinvent the wheel? So when Talita joined the lab, our newest graduate student, I told her up front, like, the thing you need to learn here is that if you help, people will help you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to help them in the future. And that's just how we work.
But, you know, and I would also say that that's the kind of the environment that came out of kind of my training. Because, again, I was an MD with very little basics research training who went into a lab, and a very high-powered labs. And so, essentially, but I brought my expertise. I knew congenital heart disease and medicine, but there's other people who had other strengths. And then ultimately I started working with another group and learned human genetics. And so then you bring in that knowledge, which other people may not have. And essentially that's what it is. It's like I walk into a room and, yeah, there's people that are smarter than me, but I have my areas of expertise, which they may not have. Right. And then it becomes this balance of where we're sharing information. And we're actually ultimately the goal that anyone in that room is like we need to solve the question, mm-hmm. you know, is like increase our knowledge about whatever we're sending. And then we all have our expertise that allows us to push that forward.
Right. So what do you think has been the Garlic Lab biggest achievement to date? If you want to narrow it down to one or maybe two.
Well, so I'll put it in two different ways. And so I'll say one is the thing that I'm most proud of is in terms of is the people. So I'll put that as just in terms of the people who've gone through the lab, be it high school students or undergraduate students, graduate students, postdoctoral trainees, is I love watching to see what everybody's doing. And I think majority, I'll never say all, but the majority have gone on to be successful and happy. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that I personally take a lot of pride in. If you were to go purely scientific, I think when we started, at least when I started publishing some of these papers where we're essentially taking genes that were known to be important in heart development and then creating mice that had two genes that were disrupted in that mouse, people were like, why are you doing this, honestly? Because, like, what do you expect that's going to happen? Of course the defect's going to be worse. But now, as we've learned more and more about the genetics of how a congenital heart defect occurs, now it's like really obvious. So, or it's becoming more relevant to understand that. So I can give the example, if you have a gene GATA4, which causes congenital heart disease, TBX5, which causes congenital heart disease, but if you have a mouse that has both of them, they have a different type of heart defect. And we've started studying nitric oxide signaling, as you know, and then NOTCH. And if you take those two and you have a mouse that has both of those genes, then you have a more severe aortic valve defect, right? So that when we initially published, they were like, this isn't boring or this isn't that interesting. You really don't understand the mechanism. But really, it's more relevant to the patients that we see because most of them do not just have a single gene causing the congenital heart defect. Most of it's going to be these gene-gene interactions. And now we're doing some stuff with gene-environment interactions, and that's what's causing it. So I want to say that we're a little bit ahead of the game in terms of really looking at these gene-gene interactions and gene-environment interactions. I think that are going to be more interesting. And I think it's going to be interesting as we can try to link some of these to our patients.
Yeah, I agree. So what's the ultimate GARG project without giving anything away to your reviewers or potential applications? Like, what would be the a big project that we haven't done yet that you would like to see us do?
So the big project that I would like to see us do right now, which, you know, it's always in the back of my mind, has been, is to take some of the genetics. And so there are some genetics that we know, right, that are causing chromosomal abnormalities, trisomy 21, 22, Q11 microdeletion, and we know they influence outcomes. But what I would love to see is take some of these other variants that we see in genes that are important in heart development and link into outcomes. Because ultimately, that's what we want to know. Mm-hmm. We want to know if you have this genetic variant, is it going to affect something about this kid's surgical outcome, lifetime cardiovascular? That's what we want to know. Mm-hmm. You know, to know why it occurs, I think, is important. It can provide a lot of, you know, counseling for families and parents. But ultimately, we're getting better at treating it. And so for the majority of defects, there's still some that it's still hard to kind of come up with a surgical cure. But for the majority of them, we have pretty good outcomes where they're living into their 30s, 40s, 50s. But they don't all do the same. Mm-hmm. And so, like, can you use some of this information to predict who's going to be at risk? Because then you could potentially prevent that. I think some of the other stuff where you're like, you know, we're going to do gene therapy at really early gestation, I think it's a little bit, I think there's going to be a lot of steps before we start doing some of that stuff. And it's not a single gene. So in order to do some of this stuff would be very tricky.
Right. Do you sometimes get tired of that question when people ask, like, why are you doing this in mice? And what does it mean for humans? Because I know I do.
I do, but I think the simple fact of the matter is that we study developmental biology. And to do it in humans is exceedingly hard. And yes, there's now better models in terms of using cells and stuff, but we are not making an organ. Mm-hmm. And so I still think there's some limitations on that. And ultimately, we're probably going to have to do a combination of things. Yes, we're going to have to use mice, but we're also going to have to use some sort of human cells to really look at the genetic contributions to obviously, all of birth defects, not just congenital heart defects.
Right. Mm. Okay. Let me see. So what do you think needs to change about the graduate school experience? I know, it's a really loaded question.
Yeah. I think there's a variety of different things. I mean, I think the graduate school experience right now is so dependent upon which lab you're in, right? You could have a very different experience if you're in lab X versus lab Y versus lab Z. So I think from that standpoint, but that's the point. It'd be nice if there was a better way to match the right personality with the right lab. So those are some things that I would just say that are a little bit out of my control mm-hmm. or ability right. to do that. It's kind of like more of a matchmaking thing. But if I were to just go at graduate school education, mm-hmm. I think the things that it would be nice when people came in, if they had an idea of what they wanted to do. Like, oh, I'm interested in getting a PhD, but I want to do public policy. Or I'm interested in getting a PhD, but I want to do more science journalism or patent law. Or you're interested in, you know, science and education and communication. And then you're on a slightly different track.
Right.
Right now, it's essentially like you are a PhD student and we are going to train you to be a principal investigator who runs their own lab. Mm-hmm. That may not be this one size fits all is probably not the best way to do it. And the idea really is that, oh, we're going to train you and then you'll later on, you'll do another postdoctoral fellowship or public policy fellowship and learn that. Mm-hmm. And it seems like it would just make more sense to start it right up front. And really, I think the other aspect is the focus of your PhD is understanding research methodology mm-hmm. and how to, you know, generate a hypothesis, look through the literature, and really do that independently. And, you know, you kind of started out with that question, like, you know, what do you think about, you know, how do you organize your lab and stuff? It's giving people independence because that's what you need to do. Mm-hmm. And it's not really that you need a result that's going to help your PI to help them get a grant. Because I think it's so focused on that, right? I think you feel pressure, or students feel pressure, that they need to get certain results to help their science project, you know, their principal investigator's science project move forward. Mm-hmm. No, they're being educated. They're students. Mm-hmm. And if it was a little bit more of a focus on their education, but then it should be tailored toward what they want to do. If they know, if they already have an idea, then they should be able to tailor them. And then that process would be different. And you would learn a lot of different things in right. terms of that. So that when you're done, that you're better prepared to move on to that next step.
Yeah. I haven't been able to phrase it like you did, but that's exactly how I feel that. Right now, we're just all pushed towards being PIs. Mm-hmm. And if we don't want to do that, then we're like the outlier. And we feel that we might be shunned or criticized by our graduate program if we don't follow this track mm-hmm. that was laid out for us. So thank you for being supportive. That means the whole world.
But I think they also feel the pressure in terms of the way they're being measured is in terms of that's how success is measured. And, you know, I kind of even went back to my lab. It's like, I don't look at my lab and say, oh, how many people have become scientists? It's like they've used their PhD or their postdoctoral research training toward some career, mm-hmm. whatever it may be, but they're actually using it. Now, if they're, you know, they finish up their PhD or their postdoc and are, you know, a fitness instructor. Maybe that's not so useful, but I've not had that.
Yeah.
But they're, you know, they're a research scientist at a company. They're, you know, I've somebody who's in India who's running, she seems in a really relatively high position looking at kind of using her platform to expand research opportunities within India and at a university. So those are different things that you can then ultimately see that they use that training to push that forward.
Yeah.
And it's not completely an offshoot where they, I don't say they wasted their time, but they didn't really utilize what they learned.
Yeah. I came in knowing exactly what I wanted to do, but I also knew that I was going to gain so much from the PhD experience, because critical thinking will just take you so many places. So that's been really beneficial for me.
Yeah. Well, but I think that's the whole point. I mean, one of the things I hope that you've noticed is that you're given a lot of independence and you're expected to learn a lot on your own.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, personally, I think that's what you should get out of a PhD, is that if you needed to, you can learn anything. And you can read and absorb literature and put together a presentation and communicate it. And that can apply to so many different fields.
Right.
I can just tell you, if you go into the business world and you say, hey, I'm going to give you an employee that can do all the research, summarize everything, and then tell you, you know, in depth about a certain topic, they'll be like, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you don't need to help them. They know how to do that. So that's the kind of, that's one aspect. I think, yes, research design and testing hypotheses, and that's a whole different aspect in terms of understanding science, but that's the other aspect of really having some independence and also being able to communicate, right? You know, I think I have you guys send emails to, you know, senior scientists around the world, and you have to be willing and have comfort to do that and not feel like, oh, my God, I can't send this email. No, you can send this email and people will respond if you're asking them an appropriate question toward their expertise.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those are that skill set that you need to have in order to really be successful, no matter what you do.
So since we're wrapping up, what are your hopes for the future for me? And anything that you've never told me, but you need to tell me now. So it can be archived forever.
I don't know. Okay. Well, I think the future for you is very bright. I think, you know, with the opportunity that you've had during your PhD, I'm glad that you've kind of pushed forward your science and your project, but you've also taking the time out to really go back to what your interests were in terms of science education and communicating science. And so it's nice to see as you're finishing up your PhD that that's kind of taken another prominent role. And I'm very proud of, you know, some of the stuff you're doing, I don't even know till it's like, you know, in our nationwide children's email inbox. I'm like, oh, I didn't know Adriana did that. Or it's at your committee meeting and you're showing me pictures of I was at this high school or this elementary school doing science education. Or you had all of these things from the lab at COSI.
Sorry.
No, but it's taking that initiative, right? To do things that can actually be impactful. So I'm hopeful that you keep that enthusiasm as you find, you know, your way through and kind of move that forward. I don't know if there's anything I've never told you. I think I tell you everything.
Yeah. True. I sometimes know too much about my MBA.
No, I mean, like, you know, if there's something I think that you're doing wrong or not, you know, I'm usually pretty straightforward. Because again, I think there's expectations that I have.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you're probably hearing, maybe I'm not saying it too directly, is finishing projects.
Right.
And I think you've seen it from other people in the lab, like how hard it is to finish a project.
Right.
And so that's hopefully something for you to remember, is like finishing a project's hard. And if you don't finish it, sometimes some people will finish it and sometimes it just sits there and no one does anything. So that's just something for you to remember with your project.
It'll get done, I promise.
No, but it's like what I actually say is, like, it's up to you, right? It's mm-hmm. like, how much do you want to finish it, and how much but it takes a lot of effort at the end. That last 10 to 15% is a lot of work. Even though you feel like I put in so much work into this project, but finishing it and publishing it and actually getting it out there is not trivial.
Okay.
So
what's the worst thing about your job?
Balancing.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I think that's the biggest thing. I mean, well, I think one aspect is balancing, and I think that there's certain aspects of the job that you have to do. So it's a lot of the administrative stuff, a lot of the paperwork, writing grants. I mean, there's just aspects of that, which, you know, I personally don't enjoy that much. You know, you do them because you have to do them. And I think that's life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if everybody in the lab has really realized this. There's, you know, with anything you do, there's good things and bad things. And hopefully the good outweigh the bad. And so for me, the good things, you know, the people studying, you know, having the privilege to study whatever we want.
Right.
That's really cool, honestly, when you think about it. Like, we can say, you know, we want to study this.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to ask permission or anything. But if we have funding, we can just pursue it. And that is really fun. And I think for me, balancing some of the clinical stuff that I do, where I still get to see patients and interact with them and kind of see where potentially the research could actually impact has been really a lot of fun. But yeah, the administrative stuff, and there's more and more administrative stuff from the hospital side and the research side. Not fun. Not fun at all. But again, you know, going back to our earlier part of the conversation, if you notice, I get a lot of help doing that.
Yeah. We know.
but that's the way it is, right? It's
yeah.
like, you know, I can do this. And then it's like trying to figure out ways so that it's not completely dumping it on someone. It's like, okay, let's share this aspect of the job
right.
so we can get it done.
But. So, yeah. And last question, what's the best thing if you have to pick just one about your people?
People. Oh, that's by no. It's the relationships with the people in the lab. And you've seen it when we get the lab together and stuff. It's those are the that's the fun.
Yeah.
That is by far and above. And I would actually put number for the lab, and I would say with the clinical stuff, it's, you know, interactions with patients and families and having those relationships.
Okay.
But with the lab, it's the relationships with the trainees.
Is that why lab birthdays are so important?
No, well, kind of.
Yeah.
It's a tradition. I think lab traditions are
why
important. That's what it is, lab traditions.
Lab traditions, like Thanksgiving. Still my favorite day of the year.
Well, you invented it.
So, yeah, thank you for doing this with me.
Okay. Well, thank you. It was very interesting.
Awesome.